Department of Education and Training, Council for Higher Education, as well as QCDO. Let me greet you this morning and suggest that we get started with the business of the day. I do want to welcome everybody to this very, very important meeting of these very important bodies that are rendering valuable services to the Department of Higher Education and Training. We've had prior engagements, but unfortunately, because of the nature of the load of work in the NCOP, we have not been able really to engage year after year. But I'm happy that at least this year, as we close the sixth parliament, we'll have an opportunity to engage and get to know the challenges and get to know more about what it involves in your APP and get to know what your targets are and also to know the budgetary constraints that you are facing. If I were to address myself firstly to the Council for Higher Education, I know that one of the main jobs is to ensure that we render quality education in South Africa at the level of higher education and training. You also advise the Minister of Higher Education and Training in terms of issues that you are picking up that will contribute to the quality of education in South Africa. You are also responsible for accreditation of courses, articulation. One would have a fair view or idea of how have you fared thus far. But also look at the issue of the budget that is allocated and the extended mandates that are going to be or are being given to the Council for Higher Education as to whether which the present allocation that you have, are you going to be able to extend the mandate and accept the mandate? Those quality councils that are going to be taken over in terms of their functions by CHE is a money following function, or are they going to be unfunded mandates? Are going to be able to increase capacity? Somewhere I read also about the deficit of about 11 million and the reduction by 4.2%, something like that, for compensation of employees. I was a bit worried. We'll correct my facts if somewhere along the line they're not very accurate. Those are the issues in the main that we're going to be looking at as we engage this morning with the CAG. How long do you take to process accreditation and things like that? When it comes to the political trade and possibility, one would like to have a fair amount of the qualifications that are being accredited by the council, the challenges that you are facing in terms of the budget. There are cases also where I pick up inaccurate reflection of revenue collection. Will you please also explain that one in terms of your APP? To what extent are you also assisting the TVET colleges to ensure that they've got proper accreditation of courses and also the accreditation of workshops at the level of TVET colleges? I don't know what is the relationship between yourselves and the CITAL in that regard, because we're sitting with a problem where most of the workshops in the TVET colleges are not properly accredited. and I don't, that would have an impact on the currency of the certificate that you produce. What work is being done in that regard to ensure that we address that kind of situation? Now, those are the issues that I just wanted to raise as we start the meeting, but the answers will come. I want you to suggest as you do your presentation, and some of the questions also will come after we have completed your presentation. I can then allow you to proceed with your presentation, starting with the CHB. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair. My name is Cassie Kruger. I'm a member of Council of the Council of Higher Education. Thank you for the opportunity to report to the Select Committee. In your introduction, it's quite clear that you have a good understanding of our role as well as the challenges that we are facing. Can I start with attending the apology of the Chairperson of Council, Professor Themba Masia, who is not able to attend this morning. I would ask you to please accept this apology. I'm accompanied this morning by one other member of council, as well as the CEO of Council of Higher Education, as well as the CFO. With your permission, Chair, can I ask them to just introduce themselves?
I'm a member of council.
I'm Professor Naren Bejnat, I'm the CEO.
Thank you. Chair, the invitation was to report to the committee the annual performance and budget of the CHE, and the format of our presentation will be as follows. I will mainly speak to the environment within which the CHE finds itself and must plan and operate. I will then hand over to the CEO, who will talk to the annual performance plan, and the CFO will follow with the budget and the issues, the financial challenges that we're facing. And then I will ask Professor Tabor to field all the difficult questions that the committee might pose to us. Before we focus on the presentation, may just allow me a minute or two to just reconfirm the mandate of the CHE. As you are aware, the CHE is a statutory body established under the provisions of the Higher Education Act of 1997 as amended. The Act mandates the CHE to advise the Minister on Higher Education and Training on matters pertaining to higher education. It also mandates us to arrange and coordinate conferences specifically relating to quality, to promote quality assurance in higher education, audit the quality assurance mechanisms of higher education institutions and accredited programs of higher education institutions. Also mandates us to publish information regarding developments in higher education, and lastly to promote access to students to higher education institutions. In its role as a quality assurance body, the CHE focuses on both program level and institutional level, which is fairly unusual. As in other countries, we often find that these two functions are separated. While the higher education sector in South Africa displays excellence in many respects, as you know, there are also many ongoing challenges that can and do undermine the quality of the system as a whole. Chair, if we can move on to the first slide. Now, the external factors in which we operate. And I'm going to mention about seven of them, Chair. The first one is there's ongoing pressure, as you know, to increase enrollments to accommodate more students in higher education institutions. We look at the number of students that annually qualify to get into university. It's clear that the demand for university education by far exceeds the capacity of these institutions. Now, this demand is growing while the resources is not increasing at the same time. The second one, Chair, is radical changes in the world of work. I mean, somebody once said that it's easier to turn around the graveyard than to turn around the university programs. That's not no further true, Chair, because the world of work is changing so fast that there's a lot of pressure on universities to undertake continuous curricular transformation. and seeing that those programs needs to be relevant and rethought all the time, it also places a tremendous pressure on the Council of Higher Education when it comes to quality assurance, these changing programs. There's ongoing challenges facing the majority, and I want to stress the majority of our students who come from a socioeconomic background, who are not adequately prepared for the demands and the rigorous university studies. We're not always sure that the school sector is really preparing them well enough. And they are not often not proficient in the media of instruction at universities. As you know, the majority of our universities are using English as the first language, while I would say the majority of our students do not have English as their mother tongue. The fourth one here is the renewed pressure for meaningful transformation in the higher education sector. We all know about the pressure around decolonization of the curriculum, so that again forces the university to change curriculum, puts pressure on the CHE. An explosion in collective sharing and the generation of knowledge online, which in turn posing serious challenges to many of the traditional roles of universities within society. We see more and more information appearing online, and universities worldwide beginning to offer programs on an e-learning platform. The sixth factor, Chair, is growing pressure on the time of academics and a specific administrative staff to complete a wide and growing array of administrative tasks in order to comply with relevant legislation, regulatory requirements and quality assurance systems, both inside the university as well as from the CHE. And then the last one, Chair, the digitization as a motor force posing ongoing challenges and costs on the university to keep abreast with affordable technology and equipment. Chair, then internal factors that is affecting and more closer to the organization itself, the strategic planning of the organization, there's a steady increase in annual accreditation and reaccreditation applications which we receive, which affects our overloading of processes and its current design. Now that's asking for us to streamline the program accreditation processes. The second factor, Chair, is the commitment from the CHE to reintroduce institutional audits for reviews in order to fulfill its mandate of auditing the quality assurance mechanisms of higher education institutions, as stipulated in the Higher Education Act. The third one, Chair, is the intention to increase the number of national reviews of programs, because national reviews has proved that it leads to significant successes in both raising the profile of quality assurance and leading to binding actions that has a significant effect on quality in higher education. The fourth factor, Chair, is the need to bring our own directors closer together so that we can stop working in silos. And then lastly, Chair, the need to introduce greater flexibility in the structure and functions of the CHE to enable greater responsiveness to the radical changing external environment that I mentioned earlier. And Chair, if we move on to the strategic outcome goals of the CHE, we have four strategic goals. The first one is the CHE as a quality assurer. The CHE is and the goal statement, Chair, is the CHE is a credible, efficient quality assurer in higher education with processes developed and implemented to inform, assure, enhance, and promote quality in higher education institutions. Second strategic goal is as a center for information, policy analysis and advice. The goal statement here, the CHE is recognized as a center for information, policy analysis and advice on higher education that informs and influences the public dialogue for the transformation of higher education system. And fourthly, the strategic goal of Quality Council, to the CHE to be a well-established quality council, promoting the goals of the National Qualification Framework in the context of the post-school education and training sector. And the fourth and last goal, Chair, is effective, sustainable, and a dynamic organization. Chair, at this point, I'm going to hand over to the CEO of the Council of Higher Education to continue.
Thank you, Chairperson and honorable members. We thank you for the opportunity to share with you our intentions and aspirations for the Council on Higher Education. And you'll see that the presentation is very detailed. It was intended deliberately to assist the committee to understand from the general to the very specific. So I won't be speaking to all of the detail. We thought just to distill a summary of the main points from the plan, which is quite lengthy and complex, so that it gives you a picture of all of the key intentions, objectives, and aspirations. So if you look at the way in which it's structured here, our member of council has given you an account of the general goals and the key goal statements. Now those, the next level of detail speaks to firstly how these are translated into programs, and we, the prescription comes from Treasury on how we are supposed to do this, and then they are audited, as you know, by the AG of South Africa. So the structure hereafter on slide 9 is speaks firstly to the first program, which is Institutional Quality Assurance. Then we indicate what the purpose is of this particular program, what the elements are in terms of sub-programs. Then the next slide speaks to what the strategic objectives are for this particular program. And then the next slide speaks to the deliverables and outputs. And that's the structure for each program. So for example, if you look at the deliverables here, our intention is to develop and refine the institutional audits methodology during the financial year. It's also over the next two financial years to complete 8 institutional audits. Now this is quite central, and it's a legally prescribed part of our mandate, is to audit the quality assurance of institutions. So much of the accreditation focuses on the program level. The other focus we have is at the institutional level, and that is very important to ensure that each of our public higher education institutions, as well as the privates, that they are functioning as higher education institutions, that where they are dependent upon public resources, that they are providing value for money, that they are equipping our graduates and our citizens with valuable qualifications, that our graduates become employable, that there isn't a wastage of resources. So we look at the governance structure, we look at the management, we look at the administration. We look in particular at how learners are supported and how their success is ensured. And that's very, very important in terms of external quality assurance, that we bring all of these things under scrutiny. And that's why the institutional audits is such an important dimension of the work of the council. So we move to the next slide. 12 speaks to the second program, and this is qualifications management and program review. And this is where the bulk of our work is. We're still in the process, as we have been for the past 5 years, aligning all of the qualifications nationally, and they are in the region of 11,000 programs on offer in our higher education institutions, public and private. That's an enormous number that we have to keep under scrutiny and quality assure. So what the first, in terms of the National Qualifications Act, so the first obligation we had was to ensure that we bring all of those qualifications already on offer within this higher education qualification sub-framework that we are responsible for. So when our colleagues from the QCTO speak, they are responsible for the TVET sector, and then Uma Lucy is responsible for basic education. So each of us have our sub-frameworks, and the alignment process is quite vital so that we have a systematic oversight and control of the qualifications on offer, that we bring them under regular review, so that we're looking at whether in terms of the content, structure, the form, the objectives of a program, that whether they are achieving what the intended outcomes are for a particular level of program, that they are that they fit in at the right level on the NQF in terms of the credit values, that in terms of the learning outcomes, that they are consonant with what the intentions are for that level of program and type of qualification. So we are almost there in terms of completing this process. They are in the region of 3,500 non-aligned programs. Now the minister has drawn a line in the sand for all institutions, and given institutions with non-aligned programs until the end of December 2019 for the remaining non-aligned programs to be phased out. So what the institutions have to do for those 3,500 programs is to present new programs, so put in applications for accreditation for new programs. So the CAG is expecting an enormous spike in the number of applications in this year and next year until that process is over. And that is that has been quite difficult without the required resources to deal with this. And we have been looking at ways in which to improve our resourcing and our capacity to deal with this spike. So if we proceed then, so pages 13 and 14 actually detail the objectives as far as that is concerned and what the deliverables are. So you mentioned, Chair, in your introductory remarks about the turnaround time. Because of the volume, remember that our resourcing has remained either static or it's actually gone downwards in the past 3 to 4 years. Whereas the mandate has become more complex, the volumes of applications have increased exponentially. In fact, in the past 10 years, they've doubled, more than doubled, whereas the staffing has remained the same. So it's got to a point where it's just impossible to maintain the same time frames. Ideally, you want the from the application to the approval for that to be done within 9 to 12 months. But the bigger the volume you are of applications you are handling, the longer the time frame that becomes. And unfortunately, that has been the case. But it's a direct consequence of not having the adequate resources and adequate staffing capacity to deal with increasing volume. And of course, it leads to complaints from the sector, and many are arguing that because of the need for them to be agile and to develop new programs which are needed by our society and by the workplace, that these longer and longer turnaround times are not helping institutions and fulfill their mandates, and I think that's correct. But that's a consequence of not having the adequate resourcing and capacity. Then if we move to 15, that's program 3, which is research, monitoring and advice. And we recently met, a delegation from the CAG met with the minister, who was quite forthright in her expectations from the CAG in terms of research and evidence-based advice. And we are mindful of that. The CAG Council and AGQC will be meeting later this month to reflect on revitalizing our role and being responsive to the priorities for action that have been identified. But again, if you look at the last financial year, because of the shortfall on the budget we had, we couldn't initiate the research which is necessary for evidence-based advice. And that's again the consequence of not being properly equipped to do the work that we are mandated to do. Then the final program, Chair, is on page 18, and that is administration and support. We have, as you know, well know, a very complex regime of governance, accountability, reporting, oversight, starting from Parliament that we are accountable to directly, but having the obligation for quarterly reporting to the Ministry of Higher Education and Training, and then the oversight by DPME, then the audit, internal audit through the governance structure of the CHE, and the external audit by the AGSA. So I think there's a general acceptance that the CHE is a well-run organization, it's well-governed. In fact, the minister drew attention to the fact that that's one of the entities that's been functioning very well since its inception, and she has no, the government has not had any problems with it, and I think that that's how we intend to keep it. But the point is that it does take up an enormous amount of resources and time to do that well, to fulfill all of our obligations, ensure that the correct policy and management regime is in place. And Chair, from slides 21 to 29, give the detailed targets for each of the objectives. And these are numerical targets which are measured by internal government structures and by the AGSA to ensure that we've achieved the intended outcomes for the APP. I won't go through the detail. I'd be happy to take questions on any of them. And then I think with that said, Chairperson, I will hand over to the CFO to take us through the budget and the financials.
Mine is just to try to clarify the issue around the budget distribution in terms of budget CHC and challenges in respect of the allocation of budget. This slide tries to repeat what we have loaded into the system for 2018-19. Taking into account that our financial year is April to March. And then what happened is that we can't be sitting in the because of financial resources. We can't be able to work. And our method of allocation of the budget is activity-based budgeting because of the kind of schedule that we are in. So what normally happens is that all program managers will cost their activity. And the slide tries to show you the loaded budget against what they submitted in terms of trying to address what is indicated in the APP. Because the activities in the APP must be costed so that we know the exact budget that is loaded. So in terms of the slide where it says requested budget, it's just an indication of saying if everything was well, that is what we requested to be the allocation of the budget. So in terms of composition of employees, the CEO indicated that the number of employees within CG did not change. We have the same number, but you'll take into account that there's an increment in terms of inflation and all that, but the total number in terms of the structure is still the same. So the total of the allocation, we can see that it's 35, and it's reflecting no shortfall of supply. So it's trying to address the issue of saying there's no supply because in terms of the allocation that we normally do, we firstly start with composition of home bodies that are there. We can't say that colleagues next year won't be able to pay you, otherwise it will relate to litigations by the employee. So the first priority is to make sure that the home bodies that you have, you make sure that you allocate the budget for them and pay them accordingly. The second thing which we try to reflect is that in terms of our prescript or in terms of our own internal policy, which is something different. We are just allocating 3% of the total composition of employees, which is 3%, which results in provision for bonus. But this bonus is just a provision. It says that eligible employees, after the assessment has been completed by the relevant structure, those that will be eligible to be paid will be paid. But this will be reflected in the annual report when the financials have been completed to say how much have we paid, which implies that next year we'll be able to report to say how many of the employees have been paid in terms of the allocation of the provision of bonus. The challenge is on goods and services. I think that's why you can say that we are trying to reflect. And I think when we presented to Portfolio Committee, they are saying we must not say a shortfall because it gives them the impression that we are budgeting on a deficit. But the intention of this slide was just to say to the members, be aware, this is a picture of where we are. But the actual fact is that we are required as management to try to reprioritize and live with the little that we have in terms of the budget. So the actual amount that was requested by programs in terms of goods and services is 28, but what we have loaded from April up now is 17. And just to highlight the reason that, yes, it's not enough, but we are trying to show to the members of every board governance structure to say, if we have 28 as requested, we'll be in a position to achieve what we intended to achieve in terms of the equity. So the loaded budget as we speak up to now is 54, and then what was requested is 65, which results in the reflection of 11.2 as a shortfall, which the portfolio committee are saying we must not indicate a shortfall because it seems we are reflecting that we budgeted for a deficit, which is not the case because even in terms of CFMA, we are not allowed to budget for a deficit. So it's not that we budget for a deficit. We wanted to show to everybody to know that this was the ideal and this is what is actually happening down here. The budget allocation for compensation of employees we can see. And just to highlight to the members, I think is known and is a basic principle that the allocation of the budget for compensation of employees depends on the different elements within it. Is how many people are within the program, the level structure of each employee. Just to highlight that under administration, which is support administration, which is comprising of the CEO office, finance, and HR, there are more employees within that area. For the fact that the CEO is under that administration because he's a CEO and there's a CFO and there's a director, hence there's a difference in terms of the allocation, it seems is higher than compared to the others. Followed by institutional quality assurance. This is the program where there is accreditation program and also institutional quality. So there are some people that are the number is higher than compared to qualification management programs and research monitoring advice. Just to touch base on what the CEO was indicating today, in terms of research monitoring advice, we only have about 3 employees or 4 employees. Same thing applies to qualification management and review, taking into account the kind of work that we need to do. We understand that SDHC, our mandate, or our work, is more reliant on peer academics. So the bulk of the work is done mostly by the peer academics. So the total composition of employees that we have is 36, there's a breakdown. The notes in terms of the composition of employees in the next slide, just that the budget allocation is based on the number, I think I did cover that. The budget covers 5,100 employees from various posts, and then it takes about 68. And I think that's where the issue that we have been raising since I came to CHE is that the baseline allocation to CHE is not enough. The baseline is not enough because if the total of the composition of employees is about 68% of what we get as a baseline, and then the rest must go to goods and services. That is not enough to can allocate to make allocation to the goods and services. And then it tries to give you the picture of the number of employees under each administration as indicated in the slide, which I think is very clear. The other slide, which is very important, is the summary of the programs on goods and services. The slide also tried to depict exactly what in the previous slide was saying about compensation of employees to say this is what we have loaded and this is what is required for each program. And just to highlight to the members that administration, as the CEO indicated, is facility. We are owning that building, for example. The building of our offices is our own building. And when you have a building, that means you need to, you will be having a fixed contract with the place, like cleaning, like maintenance. So that contributes to the allocation of the budget. I was saying to the council members, to the ESCO, and even to the portfolio committee, that for us to avoid litigation, we can't play around chipping into the fixed contract and saying we don't allocate the budget, because then it's leading to litigation. If we already contracted with somebody to do certain work, we can't say in the middle of the contract we won't be able to pay. Obviously, it will lead to litigation, and we are trying to avoid it at all costs. So it results in other programs, which is the core programs, to be affected in terms of the allocation of goods and services. So the total is about 17 that we have loaded, and while they represented 18, and that is the point where it results in 11.2 deemed to be the money that will be called a shortfall. That will result in us not achieving what we intended to achieve. The interesting part about this is that, but where are you going to get this, or what are you doing to do this? And I think it's very important to highlight to the members that the CEO highlighted, and I think it's very critical for the members to note that at the HE last year, and unfortunately, we received an additional allocation last year, which was very late in the year. It was the 13th of December, I can recall, 2017. Additional funding of 12.5. CHE normally between December and January is 12. So we cannot be in a position to expect the same institution to be trying within 2 months to spend all the allocated funds. So you won't see it now, because it's something that is going to be reflected in the annual financial statement, which has currently been audited by EGSA. Because CHE is experiencing, as we are speaking, is going to have a surplus, cash surplus. Let me just say cash surplus, because this is the cash that is available in our bank account. In terms of PFMA, we need to write a submission to the relevant authorities, which is National Treasury and DHEC, to approve that surplus so that we can be in a position to utilize it. If that approval comes, the request is that the approval must be approved as early as possible before the end of June. If it comes, therefore, that means all the ideal or the estimated budget as presented before you of 28 in terms of goods and services will be fully funded and will be able to achieve whatever it is intended. If it's not the case, that means CHE must go back during the July, August, during the adjustment budget, and try to see what we can do and what we cannot do. And I think that is a process that will unfold. But with the hope and with the undertaken from DHEC, it seems that they will really make sure that the request that he has submitted is approved, so that we can be able to get the cash, the cash that is available in our bank account. The budget proposal for the budget, as I indicated, is that the project estimated for all over is about 11.2 for goods and services, and then SCHE, we are in the process of, this was the reflection of the projected estimated program from 2017-18, that was funded in December 2017, Shift 9. And then here we are just trying to indicate to the House that the total amount, by then it was, before we submitted the financial statement, it was around 12. But what I can relate to the House is that we have submitted a letter to National Treasury and DHEC to give us a cash surplus, or approve a cash surplus of about 15 that is available for us to can be utilized. So you can see that it's an issue of the money that came late into the system, where we are requesting the money is in our bank account, the cash that is available. Give us an approval, not give us additional funding, give them approval to use that money. Not to direct back to National Treasury as normally do. And I think that is all that I can relate, and then maybe other issues will be entertained during question time. But I just wanted to stress the issue that yes, we did not budget for it deficit, because it was a confusion during the portfolio committee. It's just a reflection of the ideal against what it is happening. Thank you, Chair.
Chair, in conclusion, and I think the recommendation is on the screen, but just the last comment, Chair, this funding, it's clear that the baseline funding for the CHE is not sufficient for us to fulfill our mandate the way that we want to fulfill it. And on the short term, Chair, the lack of funding is a threat to the stability of the organization, because we're finding it very challenging to retain and attract skilled staff in an environment where we often have to compete with universities for the very same staff. And then secondly, Chair, we find that where we fulfill our function properly and where it could potentially lead to program approval withdrawal, especially when it comes to private institutions that has a profit motive, you find that we are challenged in court, as you've seen. And that is an uncontrollable expense, which we will have to find some form of a solution for. So, Chair, thank you very much.
I do not know whether the Department of Higher Education and Training, Mr. Strader, do you want to say something?
Thank you, Chair. Perhaps just to comment on the funding matter specifically, as it was raised by the CHE and quite correctly. Let me first also indicate that the department supports the request for the rollover of funding, and that request is currently with National Treasury to deal with it further in terms of the PFMA and the regulations. In the second place, Chair, the assistance provided to the CHE during 2017-18 was managed through a project fund from the National Skills Fund. They were assisted in that regard, and we are glad that the NSF could come to the party and supported the role of the CHE. Thirdly, in terms of the baseline shortfall, Chair, I think two aspects there. In the first place, the baseline of the CHE, and that is the case with all our public entities, are part and parcel of the baseline of the department that we received when the department was established in 2010. Within the department, we did all possible exercises to ensure that from our side we maintain those funds and the allocations to the public entities. In our administration budget, we unfortunately do not have sufficient funds to increase those baseline allocations to the entities. However, there is a exercise that's happening currently within the National Qualifications Framework exercise to look at the baseline allocations of all the quality assurance institutions. That involves SAQWA, CHE, in terms of the HEQC, in terms of QCTO, and then also Umalusi on the side of the Department of Basic Education. So we do hope that that exercise will be concluded before the end of this current financial year in order to go with a consolidated bid to National Treasury to increase the baselines if that is the result of that exercise of all the quality councils. Chair, then just lastly to indicate that the public entities, all of them, were also subject to the baseline reductions of National Treasury that applied to the department and all departments within government. So as a result, the baseline allocations of each entity, including the department, were reduced during the 2018 MTF allocations, and that obviously plays an additional burden not only on the department but also on all the entities to ensure that they refigure and reconfigure their allocations and their activities to ensure that there's effectiveness and efficiency within the system to be able to absorb those baseline reductions. That is something that, unfortunately, all of us have to live with. And we do hope that the entities also realize that we all need to work together to ensure that we come out with our available resources. In addition, Chair, lastly, just to indicate that on an annual basis, we also invite all the entities to provide us with a motivation to increase baselines. We do submit those to National Treasury as part of Treasury's budget process. And the unfortunate situation is that to date we have not been successful, except for the QCPO. I think that was about 3 years ago. There was a minor baseline increase specifically for the QCPO in terms of their activities. But otherwise, unfortunately, none of the other entities received baseline increases. The only other increase was for the South African Qualifications Authority at the time when the decision was taken that they must do the quality assurance of qualifications for all government employees. And as a result, National Treasury, through Cabinet, allowed an additional allocation to SACO for that process. But otherwise, we try our best, Chair, and we hope that in the future things will go better. And unfortunately, it's all linked to the economy, to the ratings of the government and our finances, and we must just hope for the best. Thank you, Chair.
Okay, thank you. Honourable members, I would request that we keep our questions to the Council for Higher Education and ask after the presentation by the QCDO in order to save time. I will then hand over to the QCDO to do the presentation before the committee.
And the members of the committee. My name is Pelu Lolwana. I chair the Quality Council for Trades and Occupation. And I'm here with me with two officials or workers, the CEO, Mr. Naidu, who is already sitting over there, as well as the Director for Finance, Mr. Kumbo Choma, who is here, will be presenting the refinances. The QCDO is a newer quality council in the environment of education. So I thought that maybe it would be better that we orient ourselves to what we're all about, what our strategy is about, what our vision is about. It is about to qualify a skilled and a capable workforce. We also are aiming to achieve the following outcomes: competent people in priority trades and occupations, which would mean, therefore, that we would like to contribute, we would see ourselves as contributing to the creation of a skilled and capable workforce in the country. Secondly, we want to achieve the establishment and maintenance of an organization that is sustainable and that is capable of doing the work that we are set out to do. In that regard, therefore, we have got three programs. We have got the program one is administration, which is the one that supports all the core functions of the organization. We have program two for occupational qualifications, which ensures that occupational qualifications are registered on the occupational qualifications framework. It's already been said by CHE that each of us three quality councils, we do have our own sub-frameworks on the national qualifications framework. Ours is the occupational qualifications sub-framework. The third function is about program is on quality assurance. when we ensure the maintenance of standards of the quality assurance of assessments, certifications for occupational qualifications. We are mandated under the, we derive our mandate from the Skills Development Act. We don't have our own act, and the National Qualifications Act. And these two acts mandate us to manage the occupational qualifications sub-framework, design and develop and review standards and occupational qualifications, quality assurance of occupational qualifications, assessments and moderation of occupational qualifications, and certification of successful learners. In addition to that, we do respond to some to the national priorities that are relevant to us, like the National Development Plan, the Ministerial Guidelines, the White Paper on Post-School Education and Training, and the National Skills Development Strategy. Then, Chair, I will hand over to the CEO, Mr. Naidu, to present to you how we go about doing our work and how this past year has been like.
Thank you, Chairperson. Good morning to the Chairperson of the Committee and to Committee members. I'll follow on from the slide where the Chairperson of Council has ended. In terms of the QCTO, in crafting our APPs and our work going forward, we build very heavily on the national priorities, and our work is crafted in response to those priorities. So in response to developing qualifications, we develop our qualifications and the processes are led by industry as well as our social partners, so that the qualifications that we do eventually register are qualifications that are acceptable in industry, meet industry requirements and industry standards, so that the carriers of that qualification are guaranteed. We can't guarantee them employment, we can guarantee them employability. With those particular skills. Chairperson, you indicated the issue around the TVET colleges. Our response in assisting with the TVET college system is the reconstruction of the NATET qualifications. We are aware that there's been huge criticisms against the quality of some of these programs, especially the NATET, the N4 to N6. And so the QCTO has reconstructed the business studies and the general studies N4 to N6 programs into what we call occupational qualifications, and we are currently busy with the reconstruction of the engineering qualifications at this point in time. And may I add that in terms of reconstructing the engineering qualifications, we are working in collaboration with some of the universities and the UOTS, University of Technologies, so that we can create a clear articulation route between our qualification and what lies in the CHE. And more than that, and if we saw the report recently in the newspaper, the number of candidates falling out from especially engineering faculties in higher education, how can our qualification make provision for these candidates? Because certainly not all of them fall out because of failing. There are a number of reasons, and we believe we can address that as well. Chair, then we contribute to the education and industry partnerships in terms of prioritizing what qualifications we need to develop. So we work quite closely with the DSPP, that's the Dual Systems Pilot Project, that is to pilot the apprenticeship model of our qualifications in the country. We work with the SIPS, which is the strategic program of government, ensure that the qualifications required in that program are available. We're also moving the bar in terms of looking to the future in terms of waste technology, which is becoming a major area of focus, as well as electric motor vehicles, solar power, and qualifications in that regard. We also respond in terms of the simplification of the national qualifications framework, and this is a big drive. In terms of the ministerial guidelines that we receive, one of the big drivers is simplification. Our system is just too complicated, especially for the learner. And so this actually underpins all of our work. So, Chair, when we talk about the simplification of the NQF, it's about reducing the number of qualifications. on the OQSF. Through the SACWA system, the system currently has about 2,000 unit standard-based qualifications on there. We have, as the QCTO, embarked on an exercise. We have actually deactivated almost 300 of those qualifications, and primarily because they were dormant. There were no learners in that qualification for the last 2 or 3 years. And then we are in the process of developing occupational qualifications, which will also replace these unit standard-based qualifications. And obviously, in terms of simplification, is the issue of revoking the quality assurance functions that we delegated to CETAS. You would recall that the CETAS has an ETQA status, Education and Training Quality Assurance status, under the SACWA Act. When that act was repealed, all of those functions moved over to the QCTO by just the NQF Act being implemented. But the QCTO, being a new organization, delegated these functions to the CETAS. That situation continues, but the QCTO in its work is gradually taking back those particular functions. It is not going easy, and I'll allude to that when I speak to the QCTO business case. Chair, I will then speak about the performance environment in which the APPs for this year have been crafted, 2018-19. And again, you can see that the environment that we work in is the simplification of the NQF. We are currently reviewing our OQSF, the framework. We do have a gazetted framework in place, but as the QCTO builds, we find that the OQSF does not necessarily provide for what the organization envisages to go forward. It's a bit too rigid for us to cater for, especially the informal economy, which is also becoming part of our focus. How do we incorporate the informal economy and allow for provision in there? Okay, sorry, thanks. Then we want to develop prioritized qualifications and part qualifications. And I spoke already to reducing the number of historically registered qualifications through deactivation of the dormant ones, replacement with occupational qualifications. And then, Chair, we have introduced this concept of realignment because we believe not everything was bad, not everything needs to be made new. So what's working in the system, we would fast-track that through a cheaper process to realign these into occupational qualifications. And then also a realignment of the skills development programs into meaningful pathways that help a learner to get towards a qualification. Otherwise, the way skills programs, not all of them, have been designed, they cater for a particular industry. And if that industry goes down, the holders of those skills programs are found wanting. So we want to have these to be meaningful parts of a qualification. And then simplification also in terms of the providers. Skills development providers were previously accredited by the 21 CETAs, as well as a handful of professional bodies, but the Act indicates that these providers will now have to be accredited by the single quality assurance body, being the QCTO, and that will then allow them to also be registered with the department as skills development providers. Chair, this slide just indicates that in actual fact, the work of the QCTO in this year, and the APP speak to that, is that we're actually quality assuring two systems and moving towards a national system. The one system is the system that we monitor, where the quality assurance of the historically registered qualifications still reside with the CETAs and professional bodies. So we monitor those, and we report on them quarterly, as well as we resolve any issues that come up around the certification and the accreditation backlogs. Chair, we are happy as a QCTO to indicate that all of the backlogs of the trade certificates that existed no longer exist, except for what may pop up in the pipeline. QCTO prides itself that we turn around the certificates in less than 5 days. The policy indicates it must be done within 21 days. And then the new system, Chair, is the quality assurance of the occupational qualifications. And through that, we have a qualification development model, and I highlighted that we use industry to help us to develop that. We're responsible for accrediting the providers as well as the assessment centers. We approve assessment partners, and that's the industry partners who assist us in ensuring that the standards are being maintained. And then we are responsible for the certification. And, Chair, we're hoping that in terms of our plan going forward, these two would align and dovetail at some point where we can then speak about a single national quality assurance system for the OQSF. Chair, the next two slides, the next slide I'm not going to go through, that it just kind of articulates quite clearly what we've been talking about, except that maybe if I must just say that we are trying to move from a decentralized system to a centralized system of quality assurance, and that's to ensure that there are standards across all of our qualifications and all of our providers. Chair, to give effect to this, the QCTO has what it calls Vision 2020, which was submitted to the department, to the erstwhile minister, Mr. Bladen Zimande. And for the strategy that spoke about the QCTO revoking the functions that were delegated to the CETAs. But that is highly dependent on the funding that the QCTO receives. And I'll speak to the funding just now, but in terms of the Vision 2020, we've identified four key areas that in terms of the act the QCTO is mandated to take responsibility for. And the first of these is the NLRD, the National Learner Record Database. The QCTO as the Quality Council must submit that data to the NLRD. In that regard, Chair, we are developing our MIS system. We're about 70 to 80% complete. It is a massive project to develop a system that will now replace what 21 CETAs were doing and the professional bodies. In terms of the skilled development providers, we will accredit the providers and develop and maintain a single database to promote public confidence. Right now, if the public wants to check if a skilled development provider is accredited, they will have to go and search and trawl through all 21 CETA databases. We are wanting that this exercise will create a one-stop position where the public could go to one site, the QCTO site, and check on the status of these providers. And then we'll manage the monitoring and reporting on their performance. Assessments, again, the policy is clear that QCTO is responsible for the quality assurance for all assessments, and we will put in processes, or we have processes in place to approve the learner results prior to certification. Chair, I think the point to be made is that certification is just not an automatic process. It is the end process ensuring that all the quality assurance processes have been complied with. Chair, then, if I just spend a bit of time on the business case, which obviously affects the way QCTO operates and its APP. Currently, we have our funding provisions is that we receive the CETA levy grant, and that's legislated at 0.5%. And then we get an allocation from the fiscus, that's from the Department of Higher Education and Training. And Chair, I think herein lies our challenge, that currently our CETA levy grant constitutes about 70% of the QCTO budget, and the allocation from the fiscus is 30%. But year on year, the allocation from the fiscus is actually decreasing in relation to the CETA levy grant. The CETA levy grant is growing by, you know, 15, 20 million a year, and the allocation from the fiscus goes up by, you know, probably 1 million or 1.5 million. So that's our challenge, that when we talk about a baseline, the QCTO certainly has a very unstable baseline to work with. And the point being made is that nobody can predict what the CETA levy grant will be in any particular year. So the QCTO has got to make an application to the department indicating that this is what we think we would require. The department would then, based on its formula, project what the CETA levy grant might be, and then the QCTO gets 0.5%. So it means that the QCTO has constantly got to alter, you know, its plans in terms of what it can do with the money that's been provided. The QCTO also charges for services rendered, so we charge for certification and for verification. It is growing, but it is not very substantial at this point in time. But again, Chair, there's a challenge for the QCTO. The providers and the system that we've inherited from the CETA system, there were no such costs to the provider or to the learner because all were funded out of the levies. And so the same providers are now saying, we have not budgeted for these activities that the QCTO now needs to charge us for. And the argument is that we are getting the 0.5%, so it should be funded in that process. The QCTO, the business case chair started off in 2016. It then got formalized as an input into the NSDP process. That was the National Skills Development Plan process. It indicates the funding requirements that the QCTO would require to execute its full quality assurance mandate. And I think the white paper actually also captures this, where it says, you know, there were unintended consequences of the establishment of the QCTO, that it was established but was not funded adequately for it to do its work. The business case proposed an increase of the grant to 1% as an interim measure, and then argued that a detailed functional transfer must be of the functions must be conducted. It also proposed that services are increased incrementally to at least 5%, and that the government grant is increased by 8% per annum, and that will help the QCTO to take it forward in terms of conducting its full mandate. Chair, as we stand, the QCTO business case was not approved pending the finalization of the NSDP. So we await that. However, we are still lobbying for the business case through the department. In terms of the organizational environment and in terms of human resources, the QCTO has implemented a new organogram based on a cluster model, and that will help us to be able to deliver. And when I talk about a cluster model, it's a cluster of qualifications, a family of qualifications that will be put in cluster. That will help us then we can start to employ subject matter experts into the QCTO and not just manage particular processes. And it also helps us to reduce on third-party dependency. Being a new organization, a lot of the work was being done by third parties, and we need an organogram that would support that we reduce the dependencies and bring things in-house. In terms of the MIS chair, I think we've spoken much about that. The chair, very quickly, in terms of the strategic goals, program one is to create a sustainable organization. And if we just jump down to the indicators, it's about building the master system plan, and that plan is approved annually, and we have an annual marketing and communication plan, and our targets are indicated in the extreme right hand there. And just to give background to the House, we've indicated what was the 2017-18 target, what was the actual achievements, but I must just indicate the 17-18 is not yet an audited achievement. It's what we've placed before the auditors at this point in time. So we've been successful on those two. In terms of program two, which is our occupational qualifications, the goal is competent people in priority trades. The purpose of that program is to ensure that our occupational qualifications on the sub-framework are available and skills development providers that offer these qualifications are accredited within a reasonable period and ensure that the providers in the system are credible. And we're really putting a lot of emphasis on that part because that's about the quality of provisioning, what happens at the level of the provider. The key functions there, as I've already alluded to, is the simplification of the framework, realignment of qualifications, and the accreditation of skills development providers. For the newly registered occupational qualifications, for the NATED Report 191, as well as for the trades. Chair, I won't go through all of the indicators, but they're on there, 2.11 to 2.16. In terms of the prioritized qualifications, we had a massive increase in 2017-18, 111. We had only had a target of 30. That was because of the influx of qualifications needing to be developed, and so we've set our target moderately at 50 going forward. We have MOUs in place for the realignments. The M4 to M6, as I indicated, those business studies were reconstructed. In terms of the skills development providers offering occupational accredited, we set a target of 90%. We achieved 88%. But Chair, I think if we put that in the context of almost 300 providers, there were just a handful that were not processed within the actual specified turnaround time. We have introduced new indicators going forward this year. If you look at 214B, we're highlighting on the historically registered qualifications, those providers. Now, if you recall, I said that was a responsibility of the CETAs. We have now made it a responsibility of the QCTO to give effect to the Act. So we will be responsible for the accreditation of those providers, but in conjunction with the CETAs, but we'll be finally accountable. And the same applies for 215B. And then, Chair, we were pretty concerned around the uptake of our qualifications. We could register them, but we have to monitor the uptake of that, and so that's a new indicator that we've also included. In terms of Program 3, which is the quality assurance, here we want to establish and maintain standards for the quality assurance of assessments and certification for the qualifications. Our key functions here is the approval of assessment quality partners, the accreditation of assessment centers, and Chair, I must just indicate that we accredit skills development providers and we accredit assessment centers. And that is our strategy to separate you. We don't want you to be the player and the referee in this. So the provider should not be the one doing the assessment. So the provider does the training, and then we've got accredited assessment centers where the learners will go and take the assessment. And that is just to build the quality into the system. Some providers may qualify to be assessment centers, but we'll ensure that there's a particular quality assurance regime attached to that. And then the approval, the quality assurance of assessment. Now, here, Chair, this is a fundamental shift in the QCTO system. The previous qualifications, learners were assessed on a portfolio of evidence. In this, all learners getting the QCTO qualification will have to take what we call an external integrated summative assessment. But it is not like the school examination, but it is a national standard that we would set, again, so that we can guarantee that learners walking around with that certificate, nobody's going to ask a question as to who assessed you, what is the qualification of that person, or where did you get the certificate. So that's a national standard that we've implemented. And it's working well with the qualifications that have rolled out. We will approve learner achievements, certification of the learners, and then upload to the NLRD. And Chair, again, on the next slide, is just the indicators and our targets. We've been doing pretty well on this. Most of the targets you can see for 2017-18 were 100%. We've been able to achieve on those. But again, the new targets is the targets where we've actually now highlighted how we will be interacting with what the CETAs were previously doing for the historically registered qualifications. And then, Chair, just to highlight the 314C, the National Artisan Moderating Body, the white paper also indicates the QCTO has to take over the QA functions of NAMP at an appropriate time, and so we've built it into our APP so that work actually commences. Chair, then our very good story to tell is the issue on certification. That's a really good story for us to tell from the QCTO. We've achieved all of our targets in terms of the certificates issued within the turnaround time, with the verifications. And we've also been tasked now with the digitization of the old learner records. We have NSF funding for 19 million rand to actually ensure that all trade records from 1950s, 60s are brought into one database, and that's the work that we're busy with. And again, this is just the work that underpins what we're doing. And some of the research work, we are really moving towards open learning and e-assessment. We believe that's the way to go. So many of our qualifications would be able to be offered as an open learning platform. And then obviously streamlining of processes to improve efficiency. Thank you, Chair. I'll hand over to Mr. Gumbachumba, who will take us through the revenue and expenditure.
Okay. Thank you very much, CEO. Good morning, members and Chairperson. I'll just take through the budget, you know, over the MTF period for the QCTO. Thank you, CEO, for highlighting the challenges that we have as an organization. I've noted when the Chairperson gave introductory remarks in terms of revenue, that we are not, we're having challenges to collect, but I'll speak to that in terms of the budget. So if we look at the slide, basically we the DHT grant allocation, like the CFO for the department has said, it's pretty much standard. It grows by 6% every month, I mean every year. Currently in this financial year it's 27 million, it's going to 28 million and then 30 million in 2021. In terms of the CETA grant allocation, the CEO highlighted the challenge of having to apply every financial year and not knowing what exactly the amounts will be. We normally, this is for example, in 2018-19, we had applied for more, but obviously the department, you know, through their formula, which, you know, they use, we've gotten less. But nevertheless, we cost, you know, our activities based on the budget that we have. So 2018-19 that is approved is 86 million, 86.7. And we are projecting in 2019-20, which will submit, that will get 104 million and growing to 126. This is based on the trajectory of about 15%, you know, the growth that it has been happening. And we, as a new organization, we haven't had, you know, rollovers that we could add to the budget. And the CEO highlighted, I think, new services that we are charging, but those are not budgeted for. It's difficult, you know, we cannot predict. It's very minimal. These are some of the issues or the revenue streams that the organization is trying, you know, to supplement in terms of what it is given so that, you know, we can achieve more. Going on to the next slide. Our expenditure per program, you see we have the three programs. We've got the audited, the medium term estimates. 2018-19 is what has been approved. You see we've got growth. I will explain in later slides the reasons for those growth or decrease. But what I would want to highlight on this is the second program, OQA, and the third program, administration. OPA, you can note that the audited for the past financial year was 41 million, which in the current year is reduced to 33 million. This is mainly because of the change in the organogram of the organization, where clusterization has been implemented. Therefore, some of the functions, for example, certification unit, have moved from OQA to OQM, hence the budget reflects that decrease. And in terms of administration, there's quite a huge jump from the audited in 2017-18 to 2018-19, mainly because we have centralized, you know, the initially we had a decentralized budget where items like rental of the building was spread across the programs. But we've centralized that now to administration, so that the core functions can stand independently and concentrate on the functions that they're supposed to do. Hence, the increase in the administration budget. Oh, and if we go to the next slide, when we talk about expenditure pay classification, I want to talk about compensation. You can see there's quite a jump. The CEO has highlighted the Vision 2020. There is an approved structure which is being implemented in phases. Currently, I would say phase one is being implemented. So we've got about 35 posts that are actually have already been advertised. But when the entire structure, depending on the funding, in fact, council took that decision because we could not, because of funding issues, we could not have the whole structure fully you know, operationalized. So it's done in phases as the funding that we have. So when the entire project has been completed, we should be able to add about 150 positions. Hence, you see the increase in the number in the figure for compensation. Goods and services, I think it's a normal inflationary adjustment. If we can go to the next slide, we just explained, you know, the increases, you know, in compensation over the MTF period. That is obviously, you know, in the region of 15% to 17%, mainly, you know, the annual escalations, cost of living adjustments, and the addition of new employees. If you check on the compensation as the QCTO, we have noted, you know, the need to balance, you know, compensation with the core functions of the organization that needs to be achieved. Hence, you know, the compensation as a ratio of the total budget or total expenditure is pretty much at 55%, which I think is quite comfortable, given, you know, that we are human resources oriented organization. So the 55% has been maintained throughout the MTF period. If I talk of goods and services, I think it's just normal increases of inflation and obviously the growth of the organization. And the ratio, again, to total expenditure is 39%, which is quite standard. In terms of capital expenditure, like I said, we are human resources oriented. We haven't got much increases because we have done a lot of capital expenditure items like construction of boardrooms, ATC, in the previous financial year. So we are not expecting much growth around that. That is the outlook for the QCTO. Obviously, like what the CEO has alluded to, if the business case is approved, these estimates will be revised. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair. I'll hand over to the Chairperson for closing remarks.
Maybe I can just close by saying three things. In the organization, every organization has got an internal language, and we always forget that the outsiders are outsiders. Our internal language has been Vision 2020. If we can simplify that, at the core of Vision 20, we are building an organization that should be expert-driven, so that it could be able to do the kind of things that it's mandated to do instead of sourcing it out. An organization that will instill common and higher standards throughout the landscape of occupational qualification. I'm sure that whenever there are organizations that come to such committees, the one thing that you will never not hear about is the shortage of funds. That is also the common language of all the entities that come here. We come here almost half positive because we feel very strongly that we do have the money, even if it is not in our bank. And we just want to emphasize that the money, whoever can help to get the money in our bank, must get that money to our bank, because we've identified the money to do the things that we think we know that we have been asked to do by the country. We have already indicated that we have started talking about this with Minister Nzimande in 2016. Every minister who has ever been a minister of higher education has heard our case to say that we do not want to continue delegating this function, our function, to the seekers, because the more the delegation continues, the more it's becoming chaotic, because the standards are not common, the standards are interpreted in different ways, and we want to be able to centralize everything in the COO. And the reason why we're saying there is money is because the CTAs are continuing to do quality assurance, whereas the function is no longer there. And with all the money that they do quality assurance about should come to our bank. So that is our story, Chair, in the committee, that we do have the money. We're not asking Treasury or anybody. We're asking to get the money that we were supposed to have to conduct and do our business. Thank you very much.
Thank you for the presentations. Department, your
comment? Thank you, Chairperson. Honourable members, no comment at this point in time. If there's any questions, perhaps we can try to assist. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much for the presentation. They are quite welcome. Although some of the issues are quite complex, and they would really need a focused attention from the side of the Department of Higher Education and Training in terms of ensuring that the functions are where they are supposed to be in terms of the relevant legislation, and that the funds should follow function. Once the functions are removed, then the funding thereof should follow where the function is. I would then open the opportunity for members to actually engage the presentation. Honorable Stock, Honorable Kaula, Honorable Mwenya, Honorable Mamburu, Honorable Lamin.
Well, thank you very much, Honorable Chair. Let me welcome the presentation by both CHE and QTCO. I think it's quite detailed. I think it's two issues. I will try to summarize them into two. It's actually three questions, but I think the other one is linked to the other one. So I will try to summarize it into just maybe two questions to CHE. I think, Honorable Chair, when we started the fifth parliament, we also had an opportunity to meet with CHE, the Council for Higher Education. And I think it's not the first time that we're meeting them as a committee. And I'm raising that because I'm picking up that every time we meet them, out of the key challenges that they are raising, there's an issue about lack of resources to execute the mandate. And this issue has been coming every time we meet CHE, and then there's an issue about lack of funding, and then the mandate, because of the vastness of the mandate, they are unable to carry out their responsibility. So I wanted to find out from CHE that since then and now, what is it that they have done to improve the situation? And then maybe from our side as a committee, we are able to actually elevate it and raise it with the minister to look at this issue, maybe try to help CHE that they are able to get maybe the necessary support that they are actually anticipating to get. Because I want to know, what is it that we are doing? Because I'm getting an impression, and I might be wrong in my own interpretation, that every time we meet you, it's like we are saying, no, this is our mandate, but this is our problem. Now, the interpretation that I'm getting individually is that it's like you are saying, no, here is the problem, give us the money to solve the problem. And I don't believe in that thing of throwing money as part of the solution, you know. Because I want to understand first and foremost what is the extent of the problem and how you have done it, and then what is your proposal to correct the situation before even we get to the situation of money. Because we as members of parliament, we have dealt with so many instances and situations where people came and then said, no, give us money, and then we allocate, we support, we give money, and then the money increased the problem that was there before. So I don't believe in that, so I need to be clarified when it comes to that. My second issue, Honorable Chair, I've noted also that the, and I think it was indicated in the presentation by the CEO, the budget for 2018-2019 financial year, it has actually dropped with 4.5% for compensation of employees, which makes it also very difficult for CHE also to appoint and fill the critical posts. So it boils back again to the issue of lack of funding. So I'm getting an impression we might be sitting, for those that are coming in the sixth parliament, we might be sitting on the same problem if we're not careful. And I'm sorry if I raise it like that, but something needs to be done, you know, because we can't start and we say, no, lack of funding, and then the budget again, because it has been decreased. And what's the reason why the baseline, the baseline budget of the CHE has actually been decreased to 4.5%. I know it's not your area, and then you don't deal with budget cuts, but there should be a reason, why the cut? I mean, if you need staff, for an example, to be able to carry out your mandate, and then still your budget for compensation of employees has been cut, what's the reason? Can you please also enlighten us when it comes to that? The 2017 articulation policy for post-school education and training made a proposal that apart from this mandate that you are having as CHE, you need to expand your mandate. Now I'm asking myself in 2017, if the policy said your mandate must be expanded, and then you've got such problems, and then also with the limited budget that you are having, if your mandate is expanded, how are you going to be able to carry out your responsibilities? I think that's my contribution, Honorable Chair, if I can just be clarified. Thanks.
Thanks, Chair, and thanks to the two entities for the presentations. I'll start with the last one, Chair, but direct my question to the department. They are reporting that they are not asking for the money, but they are asking for the function to come with the money from the CTAS. I would like to get a comment on that from the department. The second one, Chair, is the TVET colleges, whenever they come here, they always report a backlog on the issue of certification. I would like to know what is the role of QCTO in that regard, in trying to assist so that that backlog gets minimal. And lastly, in you say a new entity, in respect of your growth in personnel, when do you project to reach the ceiling? How long is it going to take you to cover if there is anything like that? And then CHE, the council made a very interesting remark in respect of decolonized education. I mean the decolonized curriculum. I remember that the minister, when we had a question session in the house recently, in responding to a question by the EFF, she even also asked the EFF to assist in making suggestions as to how this can be done. So I would like to know what do you understand by that? If you can unpack it for me, what is decolonized education? Decolonized curriculum. Because if I can make an example, when you talk about fields like mathematics, 200 years BC, 1 plus 1 is equal to 2. Then today, 1 plus 1 is equal to 2. 2018 years, AD. I don't know what it is that you decolonize this. When it comes to fields like history, there would be something like colonized areas. But again, when you decolonize, you also run the risk of politicizing. If you can just unpack this decolonization for me, how do you plan to decolonize the curriculum? And which fields, which areas? Are we talking about? You are also saying that you lack resources to provide adequate research, adequate advice, researched advice to the minister. In that regard, then how do you cope with that scenario? Where you have to provide advice, but you are saying it's not researched. You are CFO, you are saying that you have a surplus. but you say it's not a surplus. I received in December 18, 2017, you are waiting for approval from National Treasury so that you spend that. You got it in December 2017. The financial year ends April. Trying to recall what you said. Now, from December up to April, what have you been doing? Why jump to wanting to get approval for a rollover when you have had something like 4 months to put the money into programs? Because you have said again the entities at the end of every year have to submit motivations to the department for baseline increases. But you received the money in December. You had submitted previously your motivation. When the money comes, you don't know what you want to do with it. You're saying, no, 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 let me hold on to it. I'll apply for it to be rolled over so that I can think what I want to do with it. You said CFO, when you make your budget, you have what is actual and what is ideal. You received the money in December. You had planned for your actual and your ideal, but you don't hold on to the money. Why not go to your ideal and spend the money? Why wait for a rollover, application for a rollover? Because when I refer to all these things, you know, one thing to me says, no, 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 you did not need the money. You still want to try to see what you do with the money. I think I once attended a meeting. I don't recall whether it was end of last year or beginning of this year. I think the council member then, FTUCFO, was there. Of international relations, where you select committee on international relations, where you were asking the select committee to approve an international agreement in respect of the alignment of qualifications. Was it in this committee or international relations? But it was in this committee. Oh, thanks, sir, for reminding me. And if I recall, on that day, the council said they were lacking resources to be able to adequately respond to that challenge. But today they are telling us they have applied for a rollover. But on that day, the issue was, no. We want this to it's an added function, but it will need added resources. Now, the money is there, but it's not spent. It doesn't make sense to me. Thanks.
I will start with CHE, and firstly, thank you for the presentations from both the CHE and QCTO. My first question is in relation to the challenges that are faced by our students from backgrounds, socioeconomical backgrounds that are disadvantaged, the issue of the medium of instruction. This has been going on for very, very long, and my concern is that it doesn't matter how much we improve the quality of the programs and the quality of the education we give to them, but when they come from that background of from grade 0 to grade 12 having an inadequate education, as I call it, and when they get to higher institutions, firstly, they struggle with the language. And I'm sure everyone who's been into a higher institution just understands that the mere fact of being in a different environment, a very huge environment, you even struggle to get your lecture room before anything else, you know, and you get there and you find a professor there who speaks this English that you do not understand. So it doesn't matter the quality of the education you give those kids, but if they do not understand the language, the medium of instruction, we will still have the problem of graduates who go into their workplace and they cannot communicate, they cannot implement what they studied. So what can be done with that situation before we go into reviewing these programs and making sure that these students get a good quality of education? Wouldn't it make sense for us to have some sort of bridging courses? That wouldn't that help our kids from the townships to be able to be able to, I don't know, understand what is going on in those higher institutions? I don't know. It's just my thinking. Secondly, with the issue, I'm tempted to respond to Ubab Kaula's question on the decolonization, but no, I will refrain from that. Because I would like to hear the response from CHE. No. I'm very, very tempted, but it's fine. I will let it go. The issue with TVET accreditations, I'm happy. We're very happy that you're reviewing these programs, because the quality in our TVET colleges is just very embarrassing. What is happening there is not good at all compared to other countries. But my concern is also the lectures in the TVET colleges. Will their qualifications be reviewed as well? Because I struggle with the quality of the lectures or facilitators that we find in our TVET colleges. You go to a TVET college and you find that the lecturer is someone who has just completed their N6 and now they are employed to come and stand in front of a class and teach. To me, it just doesn't make sense. What can be done to review as well the quality of the qualifications of those lecturers who stand in front of our children? Again, the issue of, in slide 15, in page 5, the issue of CHE wanting to be recognized as a center for information policy analysis and all that, and advising on higher education. I'm interested in the public dialogue part. That you say that public dialogue for the transformation of the higher education system. What do you mean by public dialogue? Are you intending to involve the public and hold public participation kind of community, I don't know what to call them, where you would listen to our children in the townships and hear what they have to say about the kind of quality they get in their institutions and the challenges they face in their institutions, most especially in the TVET colleges. I think is my last question, no, it's not my last, page 10 as well in slide 29. In regards to the issue with the partnership with international bodies and networks, I would like to know who are those partners and those the bodies that you form in partnership with and your network, and what is it that you're aiming to achieve by those partnerships that will assist our educational system in our higher education institutions. Page 7, slide 21. The methodology of the new cycle of institutional audits. You say it should be completed by now. Is it completed? If not, why not? And what are the implications of it not being completed? And what are the advantages of this audit being completed? And what have you found out from those audits? My questions now to QCTO. Firstly, I would like to congratulate you for having dealt with the backlog of certification, because it's a problem everywhere. I hope it happens with our TVET colleges as well. And the reconstruction of NATED qualifications. I would like to know, the involvement of private businesses when you were doing this, did you involve potential employers for these students when they qualify to help and to assist in the reconstruction of these qualifications? Excuse my ignorance. There's something about investigating badging. I don't know what that is. So I'd like to know what does that mean? What is that? You know, I don't know whether, but I'm sure you would remember where that is. Under the other underpinning work. I don't know the page name number. There's no number there, but what is that? I'm happy, and we welcome the replacement of these dormant qualifications. We are happy that is happening, and I think that is it. Thank you very much, Honorable Chair. Thanks.
No, thank you, Chairperson. Good morning, everybody. Chairperson, I've got a few questions. On research, I want to understand, with a budget of 6.3 million, are you going to reach your goals as compared to Singapore, when it budgets, most of the budget goes to research? Then on critical vacant post, I want to know of your total staff component with regard to gender. How many women do you have on senior managerial positions? And at which percentage are you accommodating people living with disabilities? And when do you suggest you'll be able to fill some of these vacant posts? And which are they? The last question is on your staff complement. You were saying program 1 has got 22. Program 2 is 18, 3 is 4, 4 is 7. Then what is the total component of your organogram, inclusive of the vacant post? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Chair. Honorable Chair, my greetings to honorable members and the delegation. Chair, I don't have questions for the first presentation, Chair. I like the chair one because like January Chair Masilela in my province. Except to say it's a good presentation of the slides. Chair, I don't know whether you've noticed that. It's what one had been complaining about. Instead of having papers all over, you just have one document. I just appreciate this. Mm. I can associate myself with this. I like it very much. Maybe you can learn something from this moving forward. Chair, I don't have questions for them because I came at the tail end of their presentation. But welcome presentation also on the QCTO. Chair, I was checking with the chair whether they are still, when you say you are new. How new are you? How new?
Yes,
2015, I see your plan is talking about 2015. We are 2018 now. Obviously, if that is what you are normal new. Maybe with experience and other things you can say that, but I'm raising this chair because I want to start with the financial part of the CFO. We are very much economic about information. I wanted to on your expenditure versus your shortages of money. I would have wanted to see how much have you been spending from the year you started until now. Is it over expenditure? Is it under expenditure? Because that was going to tell us whether really you are short of money or not. But if you just say it without an evidence that, okay, look at our plans from this year until now, we've been overspending because of shortage of money. So I don't have that information. We're very much economic about that, as well as the report of the AG how, if you are audited, how have you been faring? One would want to know, how are you spending money, that the little money that you have. But I just want to make a statement to say, I think all of us by now, we know that as a country, we don't have money. We just have to accept that. We don't have enough money in all departments that we meet, as the chairperson was saying. All of them come with budget cuts. Even critical departments that will not live without, the Department of Health and some departments. Most of them, if not all, they have budget cuts. I think we've got to internalize that in our systems, that as a country at this moment, we're not saying we're not going to have money in the future. At this moment, we do not have money. How best can we do what we're supposed to do with the legacy that we have, especially with this chair, this, I take, you're looking at you're looking at yourself as an organization of experts. I take it you are already there. Innovation should be the order of the day with you. One who's supposed to learn, other organizations are supposed to be learning from you. If you are responsible for this function, really, innovation is supposed to be the order of the day. You are saying you're comfortable with the 55% and the compensation of employees because you are a human capital or human personnel or human capital organization. I'm not comfortable, Jay. I'm taking it now. We are in the era of technology. We're talking about a fourth industrial revolution. There's a lot you can do without human capital. Things that you can do on IT. How best have you explored that? What are the things that you are doing now that could be done? I'm not saying that we have a problem of employing people, but at the same time, there are things that you can do without humans. You just need one person. We're just attending a round table on Friday. Yeah. We learned that an organization that was having 2,000 people is now operated by 50 people. This is the power of technology. I'm just challenging you, CFO, that don't be comfortable with 55%. This money could be going to those programs that you are complaining about. Be innovative. See if what technologies that you could use to deal with some of the issues. I'm tempted, Chair, to respond to some of the issues that Honorable Ngwenya was raising, but I don't want to jump into that.
No, some
to respond,
yeah. Chair, I will ask this question. I don't know who, if there's somebody else ask it. The question of the quality of the quality that we produce in our institutions. You know, we are politicians, sometimes it's nice to stand up and say, no, we're producing a very poor quality, you know, in public view. It's easy to say that. But I'm with you today. Tell us, in terms of your quality assurance, where do you put us as a country, as South Africa, in terms of the quality of the qualifications that we produce based on your quality assurance? Where do you put us as a country? Is it of a substandard or poor? Are the claims correct? If not, can anyone wake up in the morning and say, you're producing a very poor quality of education? Can somebody say that because, there are measures that you put in place to come to a conclusion that this is a poor quality of education that you're producing as a country? Or anyone can just tell a person, it's a poor quality. Because for me, as somebody said earlier, we cannot guarantee that people are employed, but we produce employable people. I mean, these are two different things, but very important. You cannot measure that people are not employed because
and you conclude that it's because of the certificate that the qualification they have. So, Chair, I would want to be assisted on that. Where do we stand as a country? The last one, Chair, is on the certificate. You know, we have an experience as a committee that in meetings like this, we get good reports that we have dealt with backlog. I'm not saying the same thing, but I'm using it as an example. But when you go out there, you find that people have been waiting for their certificate for a long time. If you said you have dealt with, is it done? Because, Chair, I will propose that we get a report or a progress report, how they have dealt, so that we are sure we don't get a good report here. When we go to the TVET colleges and we think we hear other things. Then the last one is a comment, Chair, that said we need to remember that we are a country that has not been there all the years. As we compare ourselves with other well-developed countries, we must remember that we are a country that has got a history. We've just been in now as a whole society in 2024 years. So you can't compare us with countries who have been there all the time. I just want to make that very clear.
Thank you very much, honourable members. I think we have covered quite a great deal of the issues that one would have raised. We are engaging bodies today that are responsible for quality of education in South Africa, whether it is a university qualification or occupational qualification. And we've got concerns. I know that the employment opportunities are very linked to the economic climate of the country and business investing in South Africa. That is a fact that is known by everybody. We are having a lot of graduates sitting at home with certificates. We have said that as quality councils, you ensure employability, but you cannot guarantee employment for the graduates that you produce. In other words, you are responsible only for the issuing of that certificate, but whether or not they get placement, there is no follow through as to how many of the students that you are producing, whether it is in universities or in TVET colleges, are actually benefiting from the employment of the industry that is out there. Which is why I do want to ask particularly the Quality Council for Trades and Occupations, whether do we really involve the industry to the extent that you are required in ensuring that the students or the product at the end of the day is responding to the requirements of the industry out there in terms of employment. I'm asking myself, why is it that you are sitting with graduates in engineering at home that have qualified in some of the universities or technical? Are they sitting there because of lack of employment, because there are no spaces of employment, or are they sitting there because of the issues of employability in terms of the currency of the certificates that they hold? That would be my question. Let me go to the CAC first. There is pressure to increase enrollment in universities. We all agree. But tied with that also is the issue of accommodation in universities. Your responsibility, or one of your responsibilities as the council, is to advise the minister as to how do we tackle such issues or issues of that nature to affect the possible increase of enrollment in universities. What is your advice to the minister? I mean, building accommodation is a very expensive undertaking. And what solutions can you bring to the table in terms of solving that particular kind of problem? parents are complaining that they are renting flats that are extremely expensive. And that in itself causes students not to be able to go to school because a parent cannot afford a flat of 4,000 a month or something like that. How are we going to solve this kind of situation in order to increase enrollment? Please do explain to me the issue of whether decolonization of the curriculum, curriculum reform, curriculum transformation is the same thing. And if it is not the same thing, please clarify to us what is it? What is the actual thing that we are doing at the level of curriculum transformation? What is your advice with regards to students? I think Honorable Ngwenya did speak to this first-year students that do not know what's cutting, and as a result, they are underperforming. And as a government, you've actually invested in them through networks. And underperformance cannot be tolerated to the extent that you sacrifice students that want to go into institutions of higher learning, but you are nursing the condition of those that are underperforming in a way that is prolonged. I just seek clarity on that one. How do we make higher education as well that would answer this one? The students go to university, first year they fail, second year they fail, third year they fail. What do we do? Do we leave them to use the state money ad infinitum when the students out there waiting? Do we have a cut off time to say, because you are not performing, we now desire to give you space to people that are going to be performing and be able to succeed? I don't know who actually is auditing the quality assurance institutions. Is it CAC or is it QCDO? CAC. How far have you audited? I don't know whether I missed it in your presentation. Have you audited all the institutions that we have in terms of whether the quality that they are giving is one that is expected? It ties in also with the question, I think, by Honorable Gamino, when we say, as South Africa, where do we rank ourselves? Let us take it, the continent, in terms of the quality of education, whether it is trade and occupation or whether it is higher education, where are we? Are our students employable in Mozambique, Zimbabwe, without any problem because the qualifications are up to scratch, are up to the requirements of any state that may require to actually employ our students? The CAC also has complained about inadequate capacity to deal with applications for accreditation, takes prolonged periods of time, and the changes in the policies and in legislation. For instance, let me cite an example. The South African Nursing Council, they are operating or they have been giving accreditation to institutions to train the nurses. But that function, I think, is now being taken over by CAC in light of the fact that the trainees are having a qualification above grade 12. Therefore, they would be taken over by the CAC in terms of the accreditation of the courses. You'll correct me if I'm wrong on that one. What is the situation in that regard? Have you accredited any institutions of that nature? Or there is a halt, or what is the situation, if you could just clarify. Shortfall on research, it is a worrying factor. If in other countries, like Malaysia, there are universities that are solely responsible for research in order to guide the country to invest according to the right direction, it is really worrying. How are we mitigating this? I am not going to exhaust all the questions, but those are the issues that I wanted to establish with regard to CHE. I want to agree with honourable members when they say the funding is also determined by the state of the economy in the country. Departments have been frustrated by the baseline cuts and so on. But work still has to go on. But we shall have to take hard decisions as a country as to where do we do the cuts and where do we not in terms of our priorities. Let us stretch the range that we have the furthest we possibly can, but that doesn't absolve us from the responsibility of ensuring that as a government we fund the institutions properly so that they can execute the mandate that we have given them. Let me go to this QCDO once again. You speak of the compensation of EPO. No, it was CHE. The total percentage of the budget, the 68% of the total budget goes to compensation of employees, and the rest then absorbs with the services and so on and so on. Don't you think that is a bit lopsided? But I'm very cautious in saying that because your mandate has been extended and the monies have not been increased in terms of executing the mandate. But I'm just looking at how your budget is structured. QCTO, you said the buildings belong to QCTO, didn't you? Oh, it's AG. Okay, I'm sorry, I was confused about that. This integrated or external integrated summative assessment, I know it seeks to ensure quality, but it is not going to be a deterrent. It is not going to cause frustrations when children really will find it hard to get to their qualifications. Just please unpack it for us so that we know that it is not going to cause a blockage in terms of acquiring qualifications. I remember that we went to institutions, went in a hall, there were 400 students. The lecturer from the onset would say, by the time you reach the third year, it will only be 40 of you. So it was predetermined that for this course, so many people will pass ultimately. We don't want that kind of situation in our system. Lastly, QCDO, you did not answer my question with respect to the accreditation of workshops of the TVET colleges. Is that function still lying with the CITAS? Or are you partially responsible for this kind of function and they also have got their role to play in terms of ensuring that those workshops are accredited? Because they've got a direct bearing, I said when I opened, on the quality on the, or the currency of the certificate that you produce in the final analysis. When we take study tours, when you come back, we sometimes like to advise, knowing though that our financial position may not be able to reach the aspirations that we have emanating from the experience. Hey, but the kind of TVET colleges that you found, was it Singapore? I wish a delegation involving one of the quality assurance bodies could actually go there to have a look at what a TVET college is like in Singapore. Just to use it as a way of saying, this is where we want to reach ultimately in South Africa, even though it can be incremental. Year by year, we make an addition. Year by year, we make an addition up until we reach that kind of level. It was really an eye-opener. The TVET system in our system of education needs to be re-looked into and rearranged with a view to improving the quality of the output of those structures. I think we've belabored the point. Let us allow the department and the bodies to respond to some of the questions that the members are raising.
Yes.
Actually, do you want the CHD to be first?
It will also be first, because the
president
first.
See, I hope we can do justice to a number of very probing questions. Just the first one, as far as the advice to the minister is concerned, because a number of honourable members ask what is our advice on something. The CHE is not very proactive in its advice. We normally respond to requests from the minister to provide advice, and then that would be based on thorough research and a debate in council. So I think it would not be fair for us to give advice, but where we have opinion, I'm sure some of the members might raise it. The chair, then, if you can just allow me to just organize ourselves a little bit. There's a number of questions. The first one I picked up is around funding. The contradiction that we have around a lack of funding and then the rollover. And I'm going to ask the CFO just to give clarity on that one. The second group of questions relates to decolonization. I don't know whether we should go there. Sounds like a trap, a trick question. But I'm going to ask the CEO as well as Professor Taylor to respond to that one. Then there's a first question, quite a number of questions that results around the student, the backlogs, the social economic environment of students, the students entering the institutions with various backlogs relating to language, etc. And I'm going to ask Professor Taylor to respond to that one, because she's on the ground at UWC and she would give us some insight of what institutions are doing, you know, for backgrounds about bridging courses and things like that. And then and another group of questions I got is around the public dialogue around the transformation of the higher education system and involving who are we consulting, who are we inviting, and I'm going to ask the CEO to respond to that one. Then there's questions around institutional audits, whether we can achieve our goals and whether all institutions have been audited. If the CEO don't mind, you can respond to that one as well. Then there's the issue about lack of research or budget for research. And I think the CEO can explain that, what's the responsibility of the CHE relating to research and the type of research that's done at universities themselves. I think that we're doing very, very well on equity in the institution, but the CEO can confirm again what is the percentage of women in senior management, and then also the issue around vacant posts. And then quality of education, there was just a general question around, do we have confidence in the quality of education and the institutions that we are as quality assuring? I think again, Professor Traver and the CEO can respond to that one. There was a specific question around the South African Nursing Council that used to do quality assurance, and since the CHE has taken over, what is the progress on that? Sure, the CEO would be able to help us on that one. And then the whole issue about increased enrollments and accommodation. Although we have an opinion about some of those things, but as I said, we only respond normally to the minister asking advice, but I'm sure the CEO can give you an opinion around that. Chair, can I just then kick off by just saying that that as far as the funding question is concerned, sitting in the council, I can assure you that we have a lack of funding to respond to our mandate. The CHE doesn't generate the income. We're to a large extent dependent on the allocation from the Department of Fiscus. The only income that we generate is the fees that we charge for services rendered to private institutions. We had a debate in council, but we're trying to avoid it as far as possible to begin to also charge public institutions. But it's something that we would like to avoid. But I'm going to hand over to the CFO just to give clarity on the contradiction of lack of funds and the rollover of funds.
Thank you. Your response is that is what we want, because we've got a sitting debate on. So please, as you respond, be comprehensive but very precise and clear. Thank you. We should be out of this room by 12:30 at least at the latest. Thank you.
A quick word just to the confusion around the surplus, the budget issue. I think members must understand how the budget process works. The issue is that we do not be sitting in our office and doing nothing.
the request for for additional funding of 12.5, which I said it was approved in December, was done when the budget process kicked in for 2018. The unfortunate part, the people that have the authority to approve the budget, it only was approved in December. So I think that we need to understand that. Because when you look at our annual report for last year, we did not have a surplus. This 12.5, it was not a surplus. It was additional funding that came through because we requested additional funding. But unfortunately, it came late in the year. And I was trying to explain that this financial year, when we closed the 2017-18, which was in March, there is a surplus because of the same figure that came late. So basically, and logical sense is that if something came late, there's no way that within 2 months you can spend the whole amount that was allocated to you. And I think that must be clearly understood. And I think that's the issue where we come from, to say we are talking about the surplus because of the late approval. But the request was not done late. The approval was done immediately in when we anticipated we are going to oversee a shortfall. Quickly on the issue of the personnel, I think one of the members asked the question around the number of people. We have 51 homebodies in terms of the structure, but there are vacant positions. For example, for research and monitoring, is 3 people that have some of them have resigned because of cleaner pressures, and then also on accreditation is 3 employees that resigned, and also institutional audit we have 2, which was a director and one of the members, which is for disability, and also for quality, which is the national review, just 1 vacant post. So in total, the home bodies in terms of the structure are supposed to be 51. So we have those vacant positions. Quickly, just to the other one, which I think is very important, is the issue around the, which I wanted to address because I think it is also impacting on the same question that was asked by other members. What did we do? And I think it's very important. What did we do to address this issue? I think the member said it very well. Today, every time when we come here, we raise an issue. The relevant structure that is in place is the head of a national treasury. We have evidence in terms of letters that we wrote to national treasury and head in terms of the crisis that we are faced with. And in terms of PFMA, we need to reprioritize. And every year we are trying to reprioritize what we intended to do to make sure that we fall within the little that we have. But immediately when we have funding, then we actually change our priorities to make sure that we utilize whatever that funds that is available. So it's not that we are SCHE. We are not communicating. And I think the CFO of DHEAD has covered it well to say they are aware, because we are communicating regularly with them. There's one thing that we agreed with DHEAD is that, and I think it covers the issue of the research and advice, to say the budget is very low. We agreed to say there's a complementary, we normally call them complementary projects. DHEAD will give us funding for complementary projects to fund those projects, because some of the advice chairperson comes from the minister, but sometimes we don't have funding. Then DHEAD will give us the funding to be able to conduct the research or to provide an advice accordingly. Thank you.
I may continue, please, Chair. So the issue of decolonization is a complex, politically complex, but also in terms of the educational process and curriculum development and reform, highly contested. So the CHE has 2 publications on its website, and these are 2 policy briefs. One looks at decolonization of the curriculum, and the other looks at the HISTI curriculum in particular, and looks at what is happening. And the very big issue starts with the domination of Western canons of knowledge production. And that's historical, it's deeply embedded. So part of this decolonization is that as we've come into post-liberation, the universities have to be asking critical questions about, in the post-liberation environment, what questions do we need to be asking about our assumptions about knowledge, what knowledge we validate, what knowledge we privilege, what perspectives we privilege, what interests we privilege. Those are all fundamental critical questions. So just to give you an example, we've recently completed the LLB review. So one of the primary questions we asked of the LLB and the 17 institutions that offer the LLB is, how are you giving expression to the concepts of transformative constitutionalism? The fundamental question. And many institutions, some institutions say, well, but we are regarded as one of the top law schools in the world. So who are you to come and tell us? We say, well, you're not giving expression to the 20 plus years after democracy. You've not even changed your curriculum, which was developed 30 or 40 years ago. So you force them to go back and think about it and then meet the standards. So there was a big debate in the press you might have encountered. So that's what we do. So we force the institutions to confront them about this. So all the institutions now, in fact only two institutions, give proper expression to this in their law curriculum. And the others, we've had to drag them along consider this. And the other thing is, of course, in terms of the staffing and the perspectives that, because we come with our ideologies and our worldviews and our experiences and so on, and that shapes the way in which we see people, see the world, teach, learn, make assumptions about learners and so on. That's a big issue. So within the university, because we don't have a very representative, especially teaching core, I think there have been changes at the student demographics have changed dramatically. If you look at the figures that we publish, so they give you a very good perspective of how the student demographics have changed. But with that has come the challenge of students coming from poor schooling, coming from poor working class backgrounds who are struggling, second or third language medium of study. These are all of the challenges. So what we've done in the past 5 years as a CHE is given focus on primarily on enhancing the teaching and learning experience to focus on student success. So what are institutions doing? Sharing the good practice from a range of institutions. Also forcing the institutions through critical feedback from peers across the sector is to look at what assumptions are you making about the students? What interventions are you putting in place? Are those interventions leading to success? And we've just published, in fact it was in the press last week and from last weekend, published the latest statistics on student success. It's still very poor. We still have a big hill to climb. And we have quite a bit. If you go to the CHE website, you'll find we've published quite a lot of research on foundation programs, how we can improve student success, issues on the curriculum and so on. So you might proceed. My member of council here will also speak further on the decolonization challenges. But we've on the question of partnerships, international partnerships and international bodies and networks. So clearly, because of our role as a quality council, the interest is that about public quality bodies. On the continent, we are heavily involved in an African initiative, so the African standards and guidelines, so that there's consonance in the various African countries in different jurisdictions, so that we have a common approach to quality assurance. Because we have 72,000 students at South African universities from elsewhere on the continent. That's a huge number. So it's in our interest that the students who come from other jurisdictions go to a similar kind of quality. So whether you know a BA or a BCom in Zimbabwe is the same as a BCom or a BA here and so on and so on. So that when they go into graduate study in South African institutions, that they have the similar foundations. And as far as the, and that just answers the other question about how is our quality assurance regime regarded by our peers. We have, because ours is a young system developed post-democracy, it was benchmarked on the best systems all over the world. So the system and the regimen of quality assurance we have is internationally comparable and it's recognized as such. So in terms of the impact we make, and the fact that we are attracting students tens of thousands of students from other jurisdictions, mostly from the SADC region, of course, but we've got something like 1,500 students from the U.S. So with their 4,000-plus universities, they're coming to South African universities, it tells you something.
Mm-hmm.
And there are students from all over the world, not in the tens of thousands, but several thousands of students, especially the postgraduate level. Our top universities are comparable to the best in the world. So that tells you that when our South African institutions become institutions of choice, it means that it's regarded as a quality system. So that's a huge success. And I think that's going to, you know, we're going to recruit more and more. But we have a duty, I think, and that's our focus as a CHE, to ensure that our students, especially those who come from poor backgrounds, working class backgrounds, marginalized in society, the historically disadvantaged, that they succeed, that they get good quality qualifications, that they develop the compendium of skills and capabilities that make them employable, that help them realize their full potential, that they become an asset to the world's work. And those are the things, Chairperson, we bring under scrutiny and quality assurance. Given the challenges of time, only 12:30, Chair, there are some which I may not answer, but my colleague here might want to add something to.
When the acting chair mentioned that you now answer the difficult questions, I think what he meant actually was that I'd answer the sensitive questions. So let me make a few kind of very sensitive questions. I think we have to look at the system when we're looking at, you know, what's happening in higher education. We're looking at it at the systems as well as the institutional level. So the first point I want to make is that one of the real challenges we've got at the moment, which is linked to decolonization but isn't only decolonization, is the appointment of African staff and the recruitment of South African students at the postgraduate level. I think it's a travesty of justice that at this point in our democracy we have difficulty doing that. So how are we going to cultivate the next generation of academics for the deepening of our democracy? And I think that at the systems level, there needs to be some steerage, okay? So that's the first point I want to make. The second point is that I don't think the question of decolonization is about 1+1. Because we're clear on that. But I think the issue of decolonization is that the notion of our universities is a colonial project. And this colonial project has deepened under democracy. So we have to look at the idea of the university as situating itself within Africa. And that's where we need some form of steerage. Okay? So, for example, the teaching of geometry, Ndebele artwork, would be one example. The way in which children play in the road, etc., could be examples of how you teach it. So that you can establish a symmetry between those teaching and those learning. At the moment, we don't have that kind of symmetry. The lived experience of our students is far removed from the staff. The third point is around the notion of the language, which is an aspect of decolonization. And I think that what we might need to do at our strategic planning is to possibly consider steerage around code switching, as well as assessments, because students need to write in the language that they actually understand and can make meaning. And again, the steerage there, I suppose the point I'm really trying to make is that there are no sanctions and rewards for changes. And I think it's time that we started to provide those sanctions and rewards, because the reporting of institutions, the huge malpractices when it comes to actual reporting. So, for example, the appointment of white academics, has that increased over the past few years? My hunch is that it actually has. The last point I want to make is around the issue of quality of qualifications. And are these claims correct? I don't think we must deny that our historically disadvantaged institutions are at a huge and continuously remain at a huge disadvantage. And that under democracy, it's morphed into what we call comprehensive institutions. So the question we have to ask is that the students coming and from these institutions, they don't get employed on the market because the market is rational. Okay? So I think when we're looking at the quality aspect, we might need to establish some form of steerage that can enable traditional universities to maybe take on some of the curriculum arrangements of the universities of technology as well as comprehensives. So in other words, the system needs to be reviewed in terms of acknowledging and recognizing pockets of excellence within institutions. So for example, Mangosuthu University of Technology has in their curriculum, they've got how to build a bridge that enables the parents and the children to cross a river. That needs to be acknowledged. But what do? We focus on the established institutions. So I think in the final analysis, you know, as we move into the strategic planning and as we align our, which I think we, I don't want to overstep my boundaries, but you know, as we move into, you know, mapping the next phase, a much more closer link with our national development plan so that we can, you know, come up with kind of indicators around moving our institutions to looking and resembling what it means to be and living in Africa. So I think that's really where I think I would want to end.
On
that note.
Your responses are
really
sensitive.
Who is
the next to respond?
You still want us to...
Gee, I don't know whether we've covered all the questions. I think we've tried to cover as much as possible, just to be fair to the other parties as well. We're running out of time.
Please do give a written response. Over to the CEO.
You still want us to be concise, Chair?
No. I think we must convert them. Let's convert them.
Okay, I'm going to just pick a few that are on my interest, and I'll try to be quick with them as well. About newness. Yes, we are new, as you said, as compared to the other quality councils. Mm-hmm. I can say that convincingly because I was there in the starting of Umarusi, I was there in the establishment of CHE, and I'm here at QCTO. So I know that these processes have been sequential. They didn't start at the same time. Mm-hmm. The quality of lecturers. The Department of Higher Education is the employer of the lecturers. Indeed. And I'm aware that it's been years that they've been trying to put together a project of improving the capacity and the quality of lecturers. It's not only about NSIC, it's about the fact that lecturers in the colleges, they come from all different angles. They could come from industry, they could come from school, they could come from wherever. The issue about stressing that we need money, I think that we did qualify that our money is in the system. It's not a matter of saying there must be some new money that must be found somewhere. We just need assistance of supporting that this must be finalized. Because there is a risk if we don't get, if we're talking about 2016, it's almost 3 years now. There's a risk in the system. Things are beginning to fall between the cracks. Because we do not know, we are not happy in some cases, in some sitters, how they do the work. Sometimes we are unable to do, we can't take the responsibility of things that we have not done. So all we are asking here, we're saying, we know that the fiscal doesn't have money, but the least that can be done, this is my principle, the least that can be done is to get us to have this issue finalized. Let's all agree that the money must move with the function. About the ICT, yes, ma'am, we do agree that a lot of things can be done by ICT and we cannot afford not to do that. But let's not forget that ITs do complex work and big data because where human beings cannot possibly do that quickly because of the rules that have already been established. A computer cannot be able to do anything if there are no rules that have already been established. And the QCTO is at that point of establishing those rules and conceptual frame in order to be able to direct to the computer. We will get there, but we cannot get there from the... We still need human mind to understand the patterns, to look at judgments, to be able to make a right interpretation. Now, quality. I can talk with you the whole day, because this is my area. But I can say quality is relative. It's like beauty. Quality is for a purpose. You can find somebody to be beautiful and another one cannot. It's for a purpose. The quality and standards that you expect from a body like Umalusi is different from the quality that you expect from a body like QCTO or a CHE. What is the purpose? The purpose is around building qualifications that are going to be fit for the occupations of this country. In that respect, therefore, we can easily say that we've got buildings that are standing, we've got roads that are there, it means that our trades have been able to withstand the quality that is required by this country. We've got hospitality that is booming, we've got a financial sector. Look at the industry. We should not make a mistake of thinking that because there is unemployment, high unemployment, it's because of the quality of jobs. Those two things are separate. The relationship between the labor market and education is very complex. Last week we were sitting with the BRICS countries and we were able to realize that those China, Russia, India have done things that are totally different in terms of their labor market and employment to be where they are. So education and training is a response to a labor market that is functional. Let's first of all try to fix the labor market, create the jobs, make sure, and then education and training will respond. I'll hand over to you. Try to rush.
Thank you, Chair. I'll just deal with the operational ones. With regards to certification, I think we need to make the clarification that the backlogs that we as a QCTO have managed to clean out is specific with regards to the trade qualifications. The TVET colleges are sitting with a major backlog with the NCV, the National Certificate Vocational. And unfortunately, that qualification does not reside on the OQSF. It's residing with Umalusi, that council. So we have a very little role to play there. However, we also did pick up that there was a backlog with the national diplomas issued by the national department. At the request of the department, we stepped in last year. We assisted the department. We developed the evaluation tools for all of those programs. We piloted it on about four of those qualifications. QCTO evaluated over 2,000 applications, and we've handed that process back over to the department so that there wouldn't be that backlog there. So I think we just need to make that distinction on the certification. The Chair has touched on the quality issues, but I just want to indicate that when we develop a qualification, industry is involved from the word go. So when somebody proposes that we need this qualification, we invite all of industry. We could fill a room up with 400 different people from industry, and we go through a process of scoping, and eventually that team of 400 starts to whittle down and whittle down until we get a working team of experts that then develop the qualification. But before we take it forward, it comes back to that big group of people to say, is this what industry really wanted? Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, we won't meet, you know, all of industry what they want, but generally we're going to get that. Chair, just to indicate that we've had a problem in the country that we said, you know, we have a problem with welders. We're sitting on a qualification welding developed by QCTO that is a world-class, world-recognized qualification. And it came out through this process that because industry was involved, they brought in those international standards into the qualification. Our welders would compete with the rest of the world right now. So, by the way, our qualifications are also benchmarked against international qualifications. SACWA will not register any qualification unless it has been benchmarked against at least two international qualifications. Chair, with regards to the Integrated Summative Assessment, it is certainly not a gatekeeping mechanism. It's genuinely about standards. And if you look at our old trade qualifications, we have the trade test run at Olifants for that. It is a similar concept for any occupation. Our qualifications have three components: knowledge, practical, workplace. You have to do those three components before you even get access to the ISA. All the ISA is saying, can you do this work in the exact same environment that you'll be able to do it out there? So that's what the ISA is. It's integrated. It's not a concept of sitting and writing a three-hour examination. It might be a bit of writing theory and a bit of practical. It's a combination, but it's an assessment that ensures that if the qualification set out to do this, the person carrying that certificate will be able to do that. Chair, and then the issue of the workshops you raised. A number of the workshops at the colleges would get, and I must be careful now, I'm not going to use the word accredited, they get approved by the QCTO with respect to the qualification that that college is offering. In our qualification, we would be specific as to what would the equipment be, what would the resources be, and these workshops have to meet that standard if that college wants to offer the qualification. So we just don't give a blanket accreditation for a particular workshop. However, it is also a bit of a gray area, admittedly, in terms of what's the role of the CETAs versus the role of the QCTO, and that's mainly for workshops that will be associated with workplaces, outside. But in terms of QCTO, we would look at the workshop definitely in terms of our qualification. Chair, very quickly, in 30 seconds, the issue of badging. Badging is just another word for certification. We want to move along with technology. So badging is to give credentials to learners for parts of a qualification, which they would carry on their mobile. And so when they go for employment, it's not about looking for a piece of paper. It's about showing this. But behind that is not a piece of paper. You could actually record what that person could do. And it's quite an interesting project. We're working with the CSIR and Merck CETA. It creates a career path for the learner. So if they do that little bit, they are able to do that bit. So welding. You could be an arc welder. That's fine. You can get a job. Then you're going to do steel welding. Add that bit. You can now get that. And then it's gas welding. And then it's underwater welding. So we could build that. So that's the issue of badging and how we're going to take it forward. Chair, I hope I've covered all of that. I'll just hand over to CFO to answer the one issue quickly.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Maybe I'll apologize to say the information is not detailed enough, but we had prepared specifically for the MTS period. I'm quite happy to say that the organization is one of the CFO for the environment is here, is one of the high performing in terms of audits. We are audited by the AGSA. We are having clean audits. I think in the past 3 years we had two clean audits, including last year, which we are quite happy and to maintain. I think it will be fair for us to say the honourable member requested that they might want to see the expenditure trends from when we started. I can provide that as a written response so that the members can get a sense of where we are going. But the organisation is well managed. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the response. I just want to correct one misconception from CSE. I think it was misconstrued as having said that they sit in offices and do nothing. That is very wrong. That is very wrong. You see, Chairperson, this is not the only entity and government department that we deal with. Government does budgeting twice a year. We do budgeting now. We do a review of budgets October, November. All departments and all entities except CAG have got plans that are ready for the budget review. So that as soon as the money comes, the money gets spent. That's what I was questioning to.
No, thank you for that clarity. We have come to the end of our engagement with the quality entities.
and we are putting all our trust in you in terms of ensuring that the nation is given what is due to them in terms of finance. You know, last year we passed a bill that sought to involve the minister on issues relating to the election of councils in universities and also the issues relating to curriculum. And I remember that the universities were not comfortable about the minister getting involved on matters relating to curriculum because of the fear of the fact that we are going to move very fast in decolonization of the curriculum or reform or transformation, whatever we choose to call it. Because unless government is involved, I know that universities are enjoying a lot of autonomy. But that autonomy needs to be regulated. Because if it is not, then we are not going to see any form of transformation, at least during our lifetime. Hence the need to directly involve the minister in some of the issues that are critical, like the issue of ensuring that the curricula is beginning to tell our own story. I was happy when Malusi decided that history in basic education is going to be a compulsory subject, so that we begin to tell our own story, not to tell our children stories of other people as if Africans never existed. We don't want to get deeper into this issue because it is quite emotive, but we are really banking on you to assist us to ensure that our education system at higher education institutions transforms to accommodate the aspirations of all the entire population in South Africa, including those that were previously disadvantaged. And also raising the currency of our certification. I was happy to hear that you say that the benchmarking, we are operating at international standards. We can move anyway with our certificate and get employed. That is good. We really do appreciate that. But there is still a lot that needs to be done. The QCDO, these remarks are relevant to all of you, not only to say to all of you as to say, remember, we've given you this position in trust that you are going to work diligently to ensure that we don't find ourselves in a situation where our standard of education, our qualifications are say, oh, you come to, from South Africa, no, sorry, we can't employ you. We don't want to see that kind of situation. And also being able to accommodate students from other countries, from other African states, and the importance of the convention that seeks to standardize the qualifications across the continent so that we are able to say that as an African continent, this is the kind of quality that you're producing. The whole issue of accreditation of courses where the CHE has actually withdrawn some of the qualifications in order to ensure that they are reviewed and they ensure that quality is given to the nation. But I would plead that you don't delay in actually responding to some of the qualifications that we draw with the intention to review so that we don't keep institutions at a ransom for prolonged periods. The issue of underfunding, as a committee, we are your ambassadors when it comes to that. Whenever we meet the department, Mr. Trido will tell you, we always say, please, whenever it is possible, when you do the adjustment appropriations, consider also the entities that are assisting us in terms of ensuring quality, because we do not want to drop the standards. We want to maintain the standards, or rather, to improve the standard of education that were given to our institutions. Enhance employability, but also employment is a political issue. There is gatekeeping in employment as well. If you've got an engineering of a black boy, and engineering of an African boy, they go to an industry to seek employment naturally because of the political climate. Mm. The other boy, the white boy, will get employment as compared to, although the qualifications are the same. Which is asking us as indigenous people and Africans in this continent to get started with manufacturing and get involved in the industry. Manufacturing, and we embark on the kind of business firms so that you can be able to take in our own children. Because it would appear that really there is gatekeeping. Why is it that you are sitting with students from Mangosuthu Technikon that have got certificates in engineering? Is it not meant to say, because you have studied in Mangosuthu Technikon, we are going to take the one that comes from University of Cape Town? Is there no political dynamic at play? These are the issues that we are worried about, and we are not going to lament and cry for anybody. We need to pull ourselves by the strings of our own boots, and also legislate in a manner that is going to take this country to a specific direction. We've got all the power to do so, but we must strike a balance. We need to strike a balance. We need not to be too emotional about it, but we need to strike a very fair balance. But we need to pull ourselves from the pit, because nobody is reaching out to us. It would appear. So we are banking on you, even the institutions, the private institutions. I believe that the CAT has an eye, and also the QCO, to ensure that those private institutions that are charging exorbitant amounts of money from our students, maybe it's a week's course or a month's course, it will run into 50,000. But the currency of the certificate, the accreditation, the exploitation is something that you don't want to see. Please keep an eye also on the private institutions. There is a lot of bogus institutions that have been discovered, and what are we doing about them in terms of ensuring that they don't exploit our children, and the parents that are ignorant, they don't know. You know, when my child says, I want to go and study catering, or I want to go and study valuations in an institution, as a parent, I'll say, okay, here's the money, go. Only to find that the certificate that comes out of that, having spent the 50,000 that I don't have, it's got no value. So we are charging you also the responsibility to say, don't also only look at public institutions, but cast your eyes also into the private institutions so that you don't exploit the population that doesn't have money. With those few words, I want to say, on behalf of the committee, go and continue to do the good work. That means very good work. We are very, very appreciative of the services that you are rendering. Although we are not going to give you bonuses on the basis of that. Because we don't have the money. If we had, we would multiply your salaries even by two. But because of financial constraints, no, thank you very much. We are happy. We wish you all the best. You are not going to meet us. It is the end of the fifth administration. Next year, you'll be meeting a new committee after election. That is going to be our forward. Thank you very much.
Okay, say bala.
Thank you. Thank you.